He'll read from Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita, then have class in Bhagavatam. This is describing Srila Prabhupada's life in Vrindavan. A resident of Vrindavan. This is describing Prabhupada's living at the Vamshi Gopal Temple, which is near the Gokulananda Mandir, near Radharaman Temple, Gokulananda, then Vamshi Gopal. After stepping over the drain and walking up the marble steps, Abhay entered the front door, the driver following him carrying the luggage. Once inside, Prabhupada took off his shoes and entered the courtyard, which was open to the sky, through a metal grate on which a few birds sat two floors above. A column of sunlight lit one side of the courtyard where a potted tulsi plant sat atop a stamba. The temple of Vamshi Gopal seemed cool and quiet. Next to the courtyard was the deity room, but its doors were locked shut. Overhead was a mezzanine with rooms whose entrances were visible from the courtyard. A few saris and strips of cloth hung on the improvised clotheslines. Mahant Gopal, the temple pujari, greeted Prabhupada cheerfully. He was the same age as Prabhupada and had long gray hair and an unruly beard. Although Abhay's attire was modest, he appeared well-dressed compared with Gopal, who wore only a coarse dhoti. Actually, Sadhguru Maharaj is contrasting the vesh of Prabhupada with the vesh of the Mahant. He's saying the Mahant's vesh was tattered and coarse and simple, and Prabhupada, although dressed very simple, was very neat and clean and quite gentlemanly looking. But this is a nature we see oftentimes in Vrindavan. People are very relaxed mood. They're not so dressed up. They're very relaxed. The Brijvasis themselves are very relaxed. They get dressed up on Janmashtami, on Ekadasi. They get dressed up in different days to go see the Lord. They get dressed up when they go for darshan of Bihariji. But every day, this is the Mahant. He's just sitting around. The temple is his house. He lives there with the deity, so he feels quite friendly and quite familiar. And generally, in these family temples, the Thakur, Krishna is thought of as a family member. For example, in Radhadamodar temple, when the Mahant there, when they buy a new dhoti for themselves, if they buy new clothes for the family or new clothes for the wife, they also buy for Radhadamodar. He says, "Oh, Damodar, we're going to buy some new clothes. We better buy you some. We'll buy you some too." So then when they go shopping for themselves, they also go shopping for Damodar. Damodar Jew. He's a family member. I can't conceive of getting a new pair of pants or new clothes without buying something new for Damodar. It's a very informal mood. So there's some philosophy behind some of the reason they dress in a very simple way. Because they have a very informal mood in Vrindavan. The Mahant Gopal led Prabhupada upstairs, and Prabhupada came to the roof, and he smiled again to see the wonderful view. Barely 100 yards from his temple where he was staying, he could see the river Yamuna flowing. There were sand beaches and lots of cows and buffaloes grazing on the banks of the Yamuna. And opposite, when he looked in the opposite direction, he could see the bustling town of Vrindavan with dozens of temple spires and domes. Abhay's room, he only had one room, which was small and narrow. But sitting on the roof of the apartment were so many monkeys with their babies, and they were watching, undisturbed. Just outside the door, there was a small pyramid on the ground, signifying that below that pyramid, the deity's room was, there was a deity's room, and one was not supposed to walk over that place. And through the windows of his room, he could see the Keshigat Palace and the temple of the Gopinath, tower of the Gopinath temple. So this is Prabhupada just moving into the rooms here. He's moving to Vrindavan, he's staying here in Gopal Mandir, Vamshi Gopal, and he's signing the rental agreement, which he had already seen the room before, and now he's actually moving in. After his bath, Prabhupada took prasadam and rested. When he heard the bells ringing, he went down to see the artik of Gopal. Prabhupada had been to the Mahant Gopal had been the temple pujari for many years. The deity of Vamsi Gopal was installed 350 years before by someone in the Nimbark Sampradaya. Gopal himself had installed the deity of Radharani. Gopal is very beautiful in a threefold bending form and holding his flute. He was 3 feet tall, made of black marble. They were dressed rather simply in white cotton and illuminated by the glow of a kerosene lamp. But there wasn't much opulence because the temple was rather poor. Prabhupada returned to the roof and he watched the boats on the Yamuna and softly chanted japa in the cool early evening. And then he could hear the prayers being chanted at Keshigat. Sri Vrindavan Dham ki, Srila Prabhupada ki. So we're reminded of our Param Guru, or our Guru in Vrindavan, on the banks of the Yamuna, doing his bhajan as a sadhaka. Jai ho, Radha Partha Sarthi ki jai. So we should always think of our Guru in Vrindavan. Our Guru is always in Vrindavan, so we're hearing about Prabhupada in Vrindavan. So when we're chanting Gayatri Mantra, we chant, I am Guru Vaina Maha, Guru Mantra. So that mantra means that we should meditate on our spiritual master and his eternal service in Vrindavan to Radha and Krishna. So, Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 10, I'll read the first 5 verses because there's no purport. This is text 6? Okay. So this is, what happens is, in the last chapter, the demigods and the demons, they had come to a truce, and the nectar was produced from churning the ocean, and then Mohini Murti came and distributed the incarnation of Krishna. She gave all the nectar to the demigods, and they became very strong and powerful. But the demons were upset because they didn't get any nectar. They were very angry. So then they said, what's this? We didn't get any nectar? So they started to fight. So again they started to fight. So this chapter is the battle between the demigods and the demons. Sukadeva Goswami said, the demons and the daityas all engaged with full attention and effort in churning the ocean. But because they were not devotees, the demons didn't get any nectar. After it was all done, Krishna or Vishnu went back to his abode on top of Garuda. The demons became intolerant to see the opulence of the demigods. So they marched towards the demigods with raised weapons to fight with them. The demigods were very enlivened because they drank the nectar. They were feeling quite strong and excited, so they were ready for a big fight. So they got all their weapons, they took shelter at the lotus feet of Narayan, and they prepared to attack the demons. A fierce battle ensued on the beach, on the shore of the ocean of milk, between the demigods and the demons. There was such a terrible fight, it would make your hair stand on end. Text 6. Translation, purport by Srila Prabhupada. Both parties in that fight were extremely angry at heart. And in enmity, they beat one another with swords, arrows, and varieties of other weapons. Purport. There are always two kinds of men in the universe. Not only on this planet, but also in higher planetary systems. All the kings dominating planets like the sun and moon also have enemies like Rahu. It is because of occasional attacks upon the sun and moon by Rahu that eclipses take place. The fighting between the demons and the demigods is perpetual. It cannot be stopped unless intelligent persons from both sides take to Krishna consciousness. Om Ankaran Timurandasya Kananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Nama Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shirvaita Gadadhar Shivasri Gaur Bhaktarinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. Tvevasmi, Tvevasmi, Najivami Tvayavina, Iti Vigyaya Devi Tvam Nayamam Charanantikam. The demigods and devotees were extremely angry, and they fought with each other with different weapons. So, anger is one of the qualities residing within the conditioned soul. And anger is also there in the liberated souls. Anger is there in the spiritual world. Transcendental anger. But anger in this world, as Krishna very nicely explains in Bhagavad Gita, anger in this world is caused by frustration of lust. When lust is frustrated, we become angry. When we can't get what we want, we become angry. But what we define as what we need or what we want is due to misconception. Due to misconception, identifying with this body, thinking I'm this body, then we have so many wants and so many needs based on the body. And if we can't get those things for the body, then we become angry. So this is a product of tamagun, anger. Just like one in misconception, when one is in illusion and he's in the mode of goodness or sattvagun, a person in illusion and sattvagun, he thinks, I'm very peaceful. I'm peaceful, happy. Someone in illusion of rajagun, he thinks, I am very lusty. I'm very lusty. I want to enjoy this, and I have to eat so many things and enjoy so many men or so many women because of passion. So due to the illusion of passion, one thinks, I am the enjoyer, and he becomes very lusty. And then due to the illusion of ignorance, one thinks, I am angry. I am angry at some other person. But there is really no basis for anger, as we were mentioning the other day, because I am the same as you. But because of misconception, we think I am different than you, or you have something that I don't have, or you've taken something from me, or you've denied me of something, so I'm angry. Like Prabhupada said, if we go in the store and we buy something, and the price on the box says maximum price including local taxes, 25 rupees. And then the person says 50 rupees. He charges us 50 rupees. Then we look, we say, hey, in the box it says 25. Then we become angry. You cheated me. You're taking more money. And so we become angry. So we become angry because we think he's taking something from us or he's somehow cheating us. But when we're actually in Krishna consciousness or in knowledge, we understand that everything is happening by the will of the Lord. And moreover, that no one is different from me. I'm the same as everyone. The same energy that makes my body makes the bodies of other people. Everyone is a part of Krishna. And there's no real cause for anger. But then one time a newspaper reporter asked Srila Prabhupada, your devotees seem so peaceful. Do they ever get angry? And Prabhupada says, yes, they get angry. Because Krishna is angry. Krishna has anger. And because they are Krishna's sons, they are part and parcel of Krishna. Naturally, the son has the same qualities as the father. If the father is angry, has anger, then the son has anger. So Krishna has anger. So we also have anger. It is our nature to be angry. It is our nature. Anger is there. But it's explained, as we've heard many times over and over again, anger should be used against the non-devotees, against the demons. Anger should be used against those that are trying to offend Guru or offend Krishna, but not anger for ourselves. We should be tolerant to Tikshava, Karunika, Suridasa Vadehinam. When Kapila Muni is explaining the qualities, the Sadhu Bhushanam, the qualities of a sadhu or the ornaments of a sadhu, what are his actual characteristics and qualities, his traits? The first one he mentions is Tatikshava Kurunika. Tatikshava means he's tolerant. He's very tolerant, like a tree. He doesn't immediately become hot and angry. Oh, you stepped on me. Oh, you bumped into me. Because he has his tolerance, because he understands that, oh, things are happening by Krishna's arrangement. But in the West, especially, people have no tolerance. India is famous for tolerance, religious tolerance, so much tolerance they have. For whatever reason, due to a history of sattvic culture. And ancient India was based on sattvic qualities. Of course, it's long gone. But nevertheless, one of the byproducts of sattvagun is tolerance. One who is existing in a sattvic plane, one whose mind is saturated with sattvagun, he will be tolerant. So how do you saturate your mind and intelligence with sattva-gun by studying spiritual philosophy and by following spiritual principles, by following a path of yoga, nivritti-marg, then you become full of sattva-gun. Because everything you do is sattvic. You eat sattvic bhog, you meditate on sattvic mantras, you engage in sattvic activities like bathing 3 times a day. Cleanliness is sattvic. And chanting mantras and rising early and worshipping the sandhyas. This is all sattva-gun, and it generates sattvic consciousness and sattvic thinking and sattvic qualities. So we should always stay in this plane of sattva-gun so we can tolerate anything, unlimited things. So, but we can't tolerate an offender to the Lord, and we can't tolerate an offender to the devotees. Now this is a usual explanation we've heard of anger. Like Hanuman used his anger against Ravana because he offended Sita Devi and offended Ram. So he went there and he got very angry when they insulted him. When Ravana insulted him and then lit his tail on fire. He said, "You monkey, get out of here." And he lit his tail on fire. He became very angry. So in his anger, he burned down the whole city of Lanka, the whole island. He burned it up. So anger is a fire. Anger burns inside of us. So much fire was burning in Hanuman, and he felt relief when he took the fire out of his heart, the fire of anger, and he transferred it. He transferred the fire of his anger to the kingdom of Ravana and burned down the whole kingdom. Because this is a fact, because we can burn someone with the fire of our anger. There's a story of Krishna in Mathura when Kalayavana, one demon was chasing, he was fighting Kalayavana. And Krishna appeared to be retreating from the battlefield. So Krishna walked away very slow speed. He was just walking like a morning walk, very slowly. And this demon Kalyavana was running full speed, trying to catch him. "Stop, stop, you coward, wait, wait." And Krishna was just walking effortlessly. And he walked up a hill and went into a cave. And this demon Kalyavana, he thought, "Oh, this coward, he's afraid to fight. He's running away like a frightened dog. Why doesn't he turn and stand and fight like a Kshatriya? What is he running for? Now he's hiding in some cave. Ha! He thinks he can get away from me?" So then Kalyavana went in a cave and he saw this man lying on the floor of the cave. And he thought, "Oh look, he's playing possum. He's playing possum. He's pretending to be like an ostrich, put his head in the hole. He's pretending to be asleep and thinking that maybe he can sleep it off and I won't fight him." So he said, "Hey, Krishna, you coward," and he kicked him. Kalyavana kicked Krishna. But it wasn't Krishna. Krishna was hiding in the backside of the cave, watching. Krishna's always hiding in the backside of the cave, watching. Because Krishna's in the cave of the heart. The heart is also a cave. And Krishna is always hiding in the cave of our hearts, watching. It's another point. Krishna sees everything. He sees everything you see. And he knows everything you're thinking. So you better be careful what you're looking at. And careful what you're thinking. So Krishna's standing in the back of the cave. And then this Kalyavana, he kicks who he thought was Krishna, but it was actually Muchukunda. Muchukunda was a very powerful Kshatriya who had fought on behalf of the demigods. And he was sleeping. And he said, "I've helped you win the battle against the demons. Now give me the benediction that I can sleep peacefully. And if anybody disturbs my sleep, please give me the mystic power that I can burn them with my anger." So in his heart, he had such a fire. He had a laser beam in his heart. He had a laser generator. He had a laser generator in his heart. You know, laser beam is a very powerful substance. You can melt steel with it, the laser beam. So he's sleeping peacefully, and when Kalyavana kicked him and disturbed his rest, he woke up and he glanced at this demon, Kalyavana. The Muchukunda was a devata, you know, he's serving the devatas. And from out of his eyes came these two laser beams. They completely turned Kalyavana into ashes instantaneously. Melted him. Complete meltdown. So this is he was so angry. He had this mystic power. So Hanuman had this anger that he burned down the whole city of Lanka. Now Vanacharya gives a very interesting explanation. A new explanation of anger, which you haven't heard. Or maybe you've heard. He explains that anger is in our heart. And we should direct that anger. Who should we direct that anger towards? Should we become angry with our god sisters? "Hey, you took my Mahaprasadam. or angry with our husbands, or angry with our wives, or angry with our godbrothers, or no. We have anger. We should be angry with ourselves. We should direct our anger towards ourselves. Hey, I was initiated 6 years ago. I've been chanting Hare Krishna for 6 years and serving my guru. Why am I still full of lust? Why am I still full of envy? Why are all these bad qualities still in me? And we should just like when you're angry at somebody, like you see on the streets all the time, so there's so much anger and fighting in Kali Yuga. I saw in Vrindavan two little kids, they were working in a sabji market on Anand Mandi. And one kid, little kid, he got angry with his brother. And then they started yelling and pushing, and then his brother, so much angry, he ran down the street and he picked up a board and he came back and he was about to smash his little brother. It was a full-on like death blow. He wanted to strike his little brother. And all the Vrijvasis are grabbing him. He's about a 12-year-old kid. He was a little strong. And they're holding him back. He goes, I want to kill him. I want to kill him. There's two brothers fighting. This Kali Yuga, at any second there will be a deathly fight. There's so much anger in the hearts of people in Kali Yuga. So much intolerance. It's right in Vrindavan, two little Vrijvasi kids, they're about to kill each other. It's a very terrible thing. So, he's ready. So when someone's angry, they want the anger is in the mind and it takes vent through the senses. So that you know the eyes get red and the hands start to shake. So immediately you want to grab something. Grab a bottle. Like when drunks in the bars and discos, they get angry, they grab a bottle and break it. Grab a stick, boom. Grab a gun, boom. Because of anger. You want to vent the anger, let the anger loose. So in the same way, we have anger. Everyone has anger within themselves. They should take that anger and grab a stick. Grab a stick and beat yourself. Beat yourself. Why am I not advanced? Direct your anger toward yourself. Why am I such a fool? Why am I so envious of the God brothers and God sisters? Why am I not chanting properly? This chanting has so much power. There's so much energy and so much prema in this holy name, but I'm not getting anything because I'm sleeping when I chant. I'm not crying when I chant. I'm just Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. So I should beat ourselves. It's like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said, the mind is like, you know, we should direct our anger towards our mind. And when you wake up in the morning, because the mind is ready to take over. As soon as you wake up, as soon as you open your eyes, the mind says, what does the mind says? The enemy of the mind says, go back to sleep. As soon as you open your eyes go, bing, oh, I'm up. Then the mind says, go back to sleep. Bing. So as soon as the eyes are open, the mind is opposing you. It's opposing your progress and devotion. So then, therefore, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati says, you should take a shoe and beat your mind. As soon as you wake up, you should beat your mind 100 times with a shoe. And make it go into submission. The mind is like a tiger. And the tiger is put into submission by locking in a cage, starving him for a week. Then you come in with a whip and a little piece of food. And then he tries to get the food. He wants the food and you whip him. And he starts to understand that this man with the food is God. He is God. And I have to do whatever he says if I want to get fed, otherwise I will die. Because I've been here for 7 days, I can hardly move. So he starts to identify the man with the whip and with the food as God. As his controller, as his master. So then the man says, okay, get up, jump through this hoop, do this. And he does everything to serve his God, the man. And he gets the food. So the mind is like a tiger that has to be trained. First, denial. Just like the tiger is denied food. He's locked up. He's isolated. So that's what ashrama means. Ashrama means isolation. So you take the mind and you take your body and you go to the ashrama of the guru in the forest and you isolate yourself from maya. You isolate yourself from isolate yourself from the distractions and illusions of maya. So temple is also ashrama, even though it's in the middle of maya. It's middle of an ocean of maya, this big city. So you isolate yourself, then you deny. Then you deny the tiger of the mind. You deny him sense gratification. Vaitapasya, like Ekadasi. And then when the mind starts to growl, hey, you get the whip, you come in, snap, whoa. You crack the whip on the mind's face, bam, whoo. Then it becomes quiet. So eventually the mind comes under control of the intelligence and the soul. So this anger, we can direct it towards ourselves. This is a very interesting idea about anger. Well, because sometimes people say, oh, I feel so angry. Well, direct it towards yourself. you know, angry at yourself. Why I missed Mangalarti? Oh, this is bad. I have to get it together. And then in this verse, there's two concepts that we saw in this verse. One is that the demigods and devotees became, or not, and the demigods and the demons became very angry, extremely angry with each other, and they're fighting like anything. And the other point Prabhupada's making is there's always demons, that the predominating rulers of the sun and the moon, like Suryadeva and Chandra, they're always being attacked by demons like Rahu. So like kings of countries are being attacked by other kings, like in the old days, one king will attack another king. The Indians will attack the Pakistanis, the Russians will attack the Americans, the Germans. So one king. So it's explained that in Satya Yuga, the demons used to live on one planet, and the devotees would live on another planet. They lived on different planets. So there were intergalactic wars, star wars. There were star wars from one planet to another. So the devatas live in Swargaloka on their planets, and the demons live in Patalaloka. So they would have these galactic wars, these wars in the universe. One planet, devatas fighting another planet. That's in Satya Yuga. Demons lived on other planets. Now, in Treta Yuga, the demons came in the same planet, in Treta Yuga. So you're living on one planet, the Earth planet, and you have a Yogyapuri. Yogyapuri is full of devotees, and it's ruled by a king named Ramachandra, who was ruling a Yogyapuri. But there was another place called Lanka. That was Ravana's place. Same planet. So the demons were on the same planet. Not on a different planet. They're on the same planet in Treta Yuga. And then when you come to Dwapara Yuga, the demons and devotees are in the same family. Same family. You heard of the battle of Kurukshetra? Kurukshetra battle. That was a fratricidal war. Same family. Duryodhana against Arjuna. They were cousin brothers. So the demons and devotees were in the same family. Now, in Kali Yuga, instead of having the demons and devotees in the same family, you have the demons and devotees inside your own body. So you have these two natures. You have two natures within you. You have a demoniac nature within you, Asura Sampat, and you have a devotee nature, Sura Sampat, right in your own body. Don't forget about your own family. That may also be there. Jai Parthasarathi Ki Jai. Right within our own body, we have demons and devotees. We have some devotional tendencies, Sura Sampat, and we have non-devotional, demoniac tendencies, Asura Sampat. So now that means that there's a fight. Just like we hear about the fight between the demigods fighting the demons attacking from another planet. Right? This is what we're being described. Demigods are trying to save their planet. Indra is trying to keep his planet, and the demigod Bali Maharaj is trying to take over his planet. So now we're engaged in a fight. It's the demigods, it's us, the devotee inside of us, is fighting the demon inside of us. The demons and devotees are fighting. That's why Prabhupada said, when you become a devotee, it means declaring a war on the illusory energy. That illusory energy is not only outside here, it's also inside here. There's a whole lot of illusion inside between your two ears. Between your two ears, there's a lot of illusion. Believe me. Anarthas and Prabhupada and misconceptions. So misconceptions, the major demon that we're fighting is a demon of doubt. Shamshaya. I think it's Shamshaya in Bhagavad Gita. It means doubt. He who casts words of doubt does put the light of knowledge out. So this doubt is a great demon. And doubt is due to misconceptions. We have misconceptions about our identity. So due to misconceptions, we identify with this body, as I said before. So we think, this is my body, I and mine, aham mameti, this misconception. This is my body, and my wife, and my children, and my wealth, and my property, and my community, and my country. This is misconception. And due to these misconceptions, so many difficulties arise. So many illusions. And then we have lust and anger and all these things. Because the reality, but when you study Bhagavad Gita, when you expose yourself to transcendental knowledge and study transcendental philosophy and attain transcendental spiritual wisdom, then you start to realize Vasudeva Sarvamiti. Krishna is everything. Everything is part and parcel of Krishna. This is all Krishna's energy. And He's within everything, and everything's within Him. And everything belongs to him and it should be engaged in his service. It's not mine, it's his. It is not my wife, this wife is Krishna's. Just like Prabhupada said, the grihastha should think, the grihastha man should think, oh, my wife, she is Krishna's gopi. She is Krishna's gopi. And I should engage her, I should engage this gopi in Krishna's service. So what does that mean? She doesn't cook for me, she cooks for Thakur. We bring Krishna into our house and I engage this gopi in the service of Krishna, the deity in my house. Before it was, you cook for me, hey, cook me this, cook me that. You're my slave or whatever the idea the man has. Modern day or ancient day. But Prabhupada said, no, the husband should think, this wife is a gopi, she's Krishna's gopi and she should be engaged in Krishna's service. And I am Krishna's gopa. I am also Krishna's servant. And together we're serving Krishna. And these children are also Krishna's children. And we're raising them for Krishna's pleasure, to engage in Krishna's service and to return to Krishna. Is that my wife? To do whatever I want. Is that my husband? To enjoy however I want. My husband is for Krishna. And everyone is for Krishna. And I am for Krishna. This is knowledge. But this doesn't come easy. Bahunam janmanam ante. Krishna says in 7th chapter of Gita, it comes after thousands of births. Bahukoti janma. Bahunam janmanam ante. After thousands and thousands of births, one realizes that Vasudeva, Krishna is everything. Krishna is in front of me, Krishna is behind me, Krishna is on the side of me, Krishna age, Krishna piche, Krishna daina, Krishna baya. Krishna upar, Krishna niche, Krishna under, Krishna bahir. Krishna is everywhere. And I am part of him and I'm meant to serve him. This is life. This is human life. Human life is to serve Krishna, to love Krishna, to see Krishna, to realize Krishna. But that is very, very rare and Krishna knows that. That's why he himself says, Bahonam janamanamante, yanavamam prapadyante, vasudeva sarvamati sa mahatma sudurlava. Very, very rare. So, these demons of doubt, these are doubts. The biggest demon we have to face as devotee is doubts. And the reason we are not advancing in Krishna consciousness, why are we not advancing in Krishna consciousness? Because we're not surrendering. We are not surrendering to the process, we're not surrendering to Krishna, we're not surrendering to the holy name, and we're not surrendering to Guru. Why are we not surrendering? Because we have doubts. We have doubts are lurking within us, within our mind. Just like at the beginning of creation, Lord Brahma, he was hearing the Vedic knowledge from Krishna. Then within his mind, two demons appeared. They were named Madhu and Kaitav. Madhu and Kaitav, they appeared within his mind and they stole the Vedic knowledge. They took the spiritual knowledge out of his mind and they ran away with it. And he went, well, what do I do? Who am I? Where am I? Where I came from? Where am I going? He became foolish. He became ignorant. He didn't know what to do. And Madhu and Kaitav, they stole that transcendental knowledge from the mind of Brahma and they ran down to Patala Loka. Then Krishna, seeing the distress and the difficulty of Brahma, he became Hayagriva, a Hayagriva avatar. And he ran down there, you know, horses. He galloped down there to Patala Loka and he knocked off those demons, Madhu and Kaitav. And therefore Krishna became known as Madhusudana, right? That's why Krishna is called Madhusudana. That's why in the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna says, oh, hey, Madhusudana. Hey, Madhusudana, please destroy these doubts within my mind. Ashamshaya, Vishamshaya. He calls him Madhusudana because previously, his name is Krishna. Arjuna is sitting next to Krishna, but he calls him Madhusudana. Why does he say, hey, Madhusudana? Sometimes he says, hey Govinda, hey Madhusudana, hey Rishikesh. He uses different names. Just like you may have different names. Your wife calls you Honey Pie, and your boss calls you Joe, and all different names. So Krishna had this name. Arjuna said, hey Madhusudana. Because previously, he had killed these demons, Madhu and Kaitav. So Arjuna is feeling, demons are in my mind. Just like the demon Madhu and Kaitav entered the mind of Brahma and took knowledge. I'm bewildered also, Krishna. I'm Arjuna, but I'm bewildered. There's a demon in my mind. What is that demon in my mind? And just as you killed the demon of Madhu and Kaitav, I want you to kill this demon in my mind. And what is that demon in my mind? Doubt. And what are those doubts? What are those doubts? And these are the doubts which are keeping a devotee from surrendering. The doubts are like this. We actually doubt whether or not Krishna is really God. Is Krishna really God? I'm really not sure. Maybe Shiva is. Maybe Ganapati is. Maybe Kartikeya is. Maybe Allah is. Maybe there isn't any God. I really don't know. I'm not sure. I have doubts. We have doubts lurking in our mind whether or not Krishna is God. And then we have doubts. You know, I'm following this process, but I have some doubts. Maybe, what? I don't know. I'm not that sure. I'm not that convinced that there is a spiritual world. I mean, it's a good idea, but you know, I have a lot of doubts about it. I really have a lot of doubts about that there's actually a spiritual world, Goloka Vrindavan, with self-effulgent planets that are eternally existing and everybody's happy and they have blissful spiritual bodies and there's fathers and mothers and babies and kids and families and cows and flutes and dancing and singing and eating and playing and all these things. It sounds, you know, I mean, I'm a devotee, but frankly, I have a lot of doubts about this. Then another area of doubt is we have doubts about our guru. And because we have doubts about our guru, we can't surrender. We're holding back. We're afraid. We can't give ourselves fully to the holy name. We can't give ourselves fully to Krishna's service. So doubts must be removed. So when Arjuna heard the four verses of Bhagavad Gita, what are those four verses? They're called the nutshell verses in chapter 10. 10:8, 10:9, 10:10, and 10:11. Or 9 through 12. Anyway, the four verses. These are the four nutshell verses of the Bhagavad Gita. Aham sarvasya prabhavo, matar sarvam praparthate, then tesham nitya. All these verses. And after Arjuna heard these four verses, then he said, Krishna, param bhavam, param dhamam. He said, then all of his doubts, after hearing these four verses and realizing and fully understanding these four verses from chapter 10 of Bhagavad Gita, 10, 8, 9, 10, and 11, I believe. He said, now all my doubts are gone, all my confusion is gone, I can fully surrender unto you, and I understand that you are the Param Brahman, Param Dhamam. You are the Supreme Brahman. And he offered a nice prayer after that, two verses. So we have doubts whether or not our spiritual master can take us back to Godhead. We have doubt whether he, because one of the qualities of a spiritual master is that he can remove all doubts from the heart of the disciple. And unless and until all your doubts are removed, you cannot make advancement in Krishna consciousness. And it is our right, it is the right of a disciple, it is the right and is the duty of a disciple to approach his spiritual master and say, dear Gurudev, I have doubts. I have doubts about this and this and this and this. And they must be removed. And the analogy is given just like a sick person. Someone has a disease. He says, oh, I have a pain in my left side. I'm confused. I don't know what it is. It's some pain. Maybe my pancreas, maybe my kidneys, my liver. I don't know. My liver's over. But something. I have a pain. And I have a fever. I'm confused. I'm worried. I'm concerned. I'm worried. I have this pain. So what do? You sit down all day and worry about it? No, you go to an authority. You go to a doctor. You say, doctor, I've got some problems. I have some pains. Then he diagnoses you, looks at your eyes and tongue and everything, takes your pulse and blood samples. Then he says, oh, you have this and this and this. You have this disease. Take this medicine. Have this surgery. Have this whatever. And then you're cured. So in the same way, doubts are like diseases. Doubts, we have to go to the bona fide authority, our spiritual master. Guru. We have to go to our gurus, Shiksha gurus, Diksha gurus, whomever. We have to go to our spiritual authorities that have Krishna consciousness, that have spiritual knowledge, and we say, I have these symptoms, I have these confusions, I have these pains, I have these doubts, and I can't surrender, I'm holding back, I know it, I know I'm holding back. I'm bluffing everybody, I'm bluffing everyone and fooling everyone, and just going along, and I'm okay, you're okay. Just like the karmis, they see each other, hello, hi Mary, hi Joe. Are you okay? Oh, I'm okay. Are you okay? Oh, I'm fine. Thank you. How are you? So we're doing the same thing as devotees. We're hiding our doubts. We're covering our doubts. And we're trying to carry along, plod along, rumble along. But consequently, we're not making any advancement in Krishna consciousness. Because we're not removing doubts. These must be removed. So these are the demons within us, the demons of doubt. And this is a very crucial point of Bhagavad Gita. If you study Bhagavad Gita, you'll see that Arjuna had many, many doubts. Krishna, which is better? Is the path of karma better, or is the path of jnana, or the path of bhakti? I have a doubt about which path is better. You explain to me. Which is better? Is the personalist who is serving you as a personal bhakta, is he better, or is the jnani better? Is the Shankarite or the Advaitin, is he better, or is he higher, or is the personalist? All these doubts were presented. Questions, doubts, confusions by Arjuna. And Krishna perfectly and absolutely and clearly answered them in Bhagavad Gita. So this is the primary qualification of guru. One is guru if he can remove all your doubts. That person you should, because then you can surrender. Yes, I'm sure. Because we have doubts about the position of our guru. Oh, my guru is a nice guy. He's a nice guy, but I'm really not sure if he has love of Godhead. And I'm really not sure if he can liberate me. And I'm really not sure if he can reveal my sarup. And I'm really not sure if he's going to be able to take me back to Godhead. If we have these doubts, I'm not saying that you do, but if you have these doubts, then that's not your guru. All that should be clear. It should be very clear in your mind before you surrender to someone. That this person, because otherwise you're going to meet a block. If you prematurely take diksha from someone, you're going to run into an impasse. You're going to run into an obstacle or a block. And it's called doubt. Well, wait a minute. You know, I took initiation a few years ago, but you know, now I'm really not sure. I mean, I don't know. And I'm confused and I'm afraid to ask him and I don't know. And this is a problem. This is called doubts. And they put out the fire of knowledge. So this is the biggest enemy that we have, the biggest demon that we have. Our anger should be directed towards ourselves. That's one point of the class, the first point. If we have anger, we should direct it towards ourselves and beat down all our bad qualities and take a stick and beat down our lust and beat down our greed and beat down our envy. Because we have all these bad things in us, so should we use our anger against ourselves? And then the second point is this doubts. There's a fight between the demons and devotees in this verse, in this section of Bhagavatam. But the real fight is a fight that we're having against the demons within us. But of course, there's some consolation. There's a great consolation. And that comfort, or that solace, or consolation, is the mercy of Krishna. I want to close by reading some very reassuring verses from the Srimad Bhagavatam. You'll be interested to know that we're discussing this section of Bhagavatam, which is a fight between the demons and the demigods. Now, when you become a devotee of Krishna and tread the path of Nivritti Marg and try to perform Bhakti Yoga, you know who becomes your enemy? You know who becomes your enemy when you become a devotee? The demigods! The demigods become your enemy! So you're reading now about the demigods and the demons, the demigods fighting the asuras, and so you think, when you're reading this section of the Bhagavatam, yeah, that's us. We're the good guys. Yeah, when you watch a movie, usually you identify. You identify with the guy wearing black, the bad guy, or you identify with the good guy, with the white horse. So when you're reading this story about the demigods and the demons, naturally you identify with these suras, because you think you're a demigod, you're a sura, you're a saintly, you're a devotee. And the Bali Maharaj and the Daityas, those are the bad guys. And of course they are. Because they're against Dharma, they're against Krishna consciousness, they're full of greed, they're lusty, they represent all demoniac bad qualities, or selfish. Okay. But now, when you become a devotee, a Krishna Bhakta, the demigods become your enemy. The very demigods who you identify with in the movie, now they're going against you. That we'll hear from the Bhagavatam, we'll hear about that. And then it says, also in this Uddhava Gita, it says, they're your enemy when you're a brahmachari. The demigods are your enemy. They're your enemy when you're a grihastha. And they're your enemy when you're a vanapras. And the demigods are your really big enemy when you take sannyas. They become a really big enemy. Because when they see that you're taking sannyas, they understand that if you follow the vow of sannyas very tightly, you can get the post of Indra. You can become Indra as a years. So naturally, Indra's thinking, hey, buddy. Hey, Maharaj. Jai Ho, Maharaj. He wants to take my post. And they get disturbed. Even though you're a Vaishnava, Tridandi, Bhikshu, even though you're a Bhakta, Krishna Bhakta, and you're a sannyasi, it's explained in the Bhagavatam, 11th canto, Krishna tells Uddhava in Uddhava Gita, hey, watch out, Maharaj. Hey, Maharaj, watch out. Mohan, Maharaj. Because the demigods are so envious, The demigods are your enemies. Not only doubts inside, but the demigods become your enemy. Hey, Maharaj, you know what they do? Krishna tells Uddhava. He says, the demigods, they take the form of your wife. And they come and they try to make you fall down from the path. The demigods come in, they take the form of your wife, and they come and try to seduce you and break your vows. Because they see that you're getting out. You're getting liberated. And on your way out, because when you get liberated, you go by the heavenly planets, and you get a chance to look outside the window of your airplane. It's like you're driving your Air India airplane and say, on your left-hand side, if you look out the window, you can see the mountain peaks of Switzerland. On your right-hand side, you can see Lake Mayavadi. Whatever. So the same way, when you're getting liberated and traveling through the coverings of the universe, you can get a chance to get distracted to the different... The devatas of the different layers of the universe are waiting to offer you attractions. You go through the covering of earth, and Prithvi Devi offers you so many opulences. You go through the layer of fire and Agni Devi. So many things are there described in Bhagavad literature. As a soul is getting liberated from the material world. So the sannyasi is getting liberated, no doubt. But then the demigods, they take the form of the wife, they try to break him. Because when he is getting liberated, he may go by Indra's planet and look out. Hey, that looks pretty good. Nandakanan forest. Then he goes over there and Indra gets bumped out and he sits down and takes over. So demigods come as your previous wife, or they take the form of some other lady. They come with some other lady, and you're sitting in your kutir, and they come into your kutir. Jai Ho Maharaj. Late at night, you're sitting in a cave and you're chanting Hare Krishna. And your name is Haridas Thakur. And the demigods take the form of a prostitute. And they come to break your vow. Because Haridas was sannyasi. He was renounced. He was sannyas. And so they came, the demigods came in the form of this prostitute to break him. So this happens. So that's told. But now, this section here in Bhagavatam, it explains, it's very nice. Krishna speaking to Uddhava at the same point. Madhyamano pi madbhakto vishayer ajitendriyaha prayak prakalvaya bhaktya vishayer navibhuyate. He says, my dear Uddhava, if my devotee has not fully conquered his senses, he may be harassed by material desires. But because of his unflinching devotion for me, he will not be defeated by sense gratification. So that's another enemy. Doubts are the biggest enemy. The biggest enemy a devotee has is doubts. But the second biggest enemy is sense gratification. Purport. Because of previous bad habits and immaturity, even a sincere devotee may be harassed by lingering attraction to the bodily concept of life. But because he has unflinching devotion for Krishna, that will act to protect and save him. Vishwanath Chakravartipad gives two very wonderful examples. Just like in the battlefield, a great warrior, a great fighter, may be struck by an arrow, may be struck here or here in the arm by an arrow from his enemy. But because of his courage and strength, he is not killed or defeated. I told this before. He accepts that blow, or that arrow, and he goes on to victory. Similarly, one may contract a disease, but if he takes proper medicine, is quickly cured. Well, similarly, sometimes a devotee, he's a sincere devotee, he has devotion for Krishna, but he's hit by the enemies. The enemies of sense gratification hit him with a few arrows, like we read in this verse. Banai, arrows, the word is there, banai. The demigods, they were throwing arrows and clubs and tridents. So Maya may hit us with an arrow. We may fall down temporarily, get wounded, and fall down into some sense gratification. But by the strength and courage of our devotion, we will not be defeated. We will not fall from the path or give up Krishna consciousness. A devotee, however immature he may be, never falls from the path of devotional service. Even if he displays some occasional weakness, he is still considered a devotee if his devotion to Krishna is very strong. So now, that's one point. Now the other point explains how the demigods, this other verse, Krishna explains how the demigods harass the devotees. So, this is very nice. Tam surakrita mahavantaraya svako vilangya paramam rajatam padam de nanyasya barhishi balin daratak sabhagan datte padam tramavita dari vignamurdni. The demigods, Indra, Chandra, Surya, Brahma, Shiva, Kartikeya, Ganapati, all the demigods, you know the demigods, you know the names, there's 33 crore. The demigods place many obstacles on the path of those who worship Krishna and who try to transcend the temporary abodes of the demigods and reach the supreme abode of Lord Krishna. Those who offer the demigods their assigned share in the sacrificial performances encounter no such obstacles. But because you are the direct protector of your devotee, the devotee is able to step over the head of whatever obstacle the demigods may place before him. So each one of us are being opposed by the demigods. The sannyasis get the most opposition because they're the biggest threat. If you're a small timer, no one pays any attention, but if you're big and powerful, then you'd have to more of a threat. So the demigod, the sannyasis are a big threat to the demigods. Because if they hold on to their vows, they can take over the planets of the demigods. But the Samagrihastha Vanaprastha, it's not, they don't get that benediction, it's not there. But still, so the purport, although a Vaishnav, devotee of the Lord, has no need to worship the demigods being proud of their exalted position, material position, sometimes resent. They become resentful and hateful and angry with the devotees of Lord Krishna because of the devotees' exclusive devotion to the Lord. And thus, the demigods try to cause the devotees to fall down. Interesting, we're hearing, you know, we're reading about the demigods and the demons, so of course, as I mentioned, you know, we're, jai, demigods, come on, demigods, beat those demons. Well, wait a minute, he's saying demigods are my enemies also. Krishna speaking. Well, wait a minute, oh, I'm going to get on the side of the demons. Let's get on the side of the demons and beat up the demigods. No, that's not the way either. We stay on the side of Krishna. The demigods try to cause the devotee to fall down, as described in this verse, Sura Krita Bhavon Tarya. But the demigods here point out that Krishna is directly the protector of his devotees. Therefore, the so-called obstacles and impediments that the demigods place in front of the devotees, they become stimuli or impetus or the inspiration for further spiritual advancement of a sincere devotee. They have a phrase, in other words, the demigods try to block your advancement and stop your advancement by filling you full of doubts, by creating attraction and allurements to the material energy, making you attracted to maya, intoxication, drugs, sex, gambling, all kinds of enjoyment and perversions. The demigods create these things. They're obstacles. But if you're a sincere devotee, you take them as tests and say no. You say no to maya. No, I don't want this. And you hold on to Krishna's holy name very tightly. And you hold on to the lotus feet of your guru very tightly. And you cross over the heads of these obstacles. So it becomes a stimulation, it becomes an inspiration to advance. They have a phrase in business in the Western world, they say, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. In other words, if you're going along your path and all of a sudden it becomes very difficult to go, and there's so many obstacles, rather than sitting down and quitting, you say, oh, it's so hard to go, the road is so difficult. No, you say, okay, if you say you're driving in a Maruti or something, a little Jeep, and you're driving down the road and it becomes very difficult, you could just say, oh, it's too hard to drive. No, instead you take one lever, you put it in four wheel, boom, and then you downshift into second gear and you step on the gas, boom, and you fly over the bumps. So when it becomes more difficult and there's all kinds of water in your path and flooding conditions on the road, you simply throw into the four wheel drive, downshift into second gear and step on the gas. So when the going gets tough, the tough get going. So when you get challenged and you meet obstacles, rather than sitting down crying, oh, Prabhu, it's so hard, it's so difficult, I can't go on, I can't chant, I can't serve, it's too hard, I'm going back to my mother. Mom! Because, you know, in Indian families, the mother is always waiting with wide open arms. Come on home, son. Don't worry. Those Krishnas give you a hard time. Come on back. Plenty of samosas, lots of halva, all the TV you want to watch, car, money, clothes, anything. Come on home. I'll give you a hug and a kiss, and everything's okay. Yeah. And so that's in the back of our mind. We have that in the back of our mind. Your mother's standing with her open arms inviting you. Come on home, son. Everything's okay. If the Krishnas give you a hard time, just come back to mommy. Come back to mommy and stay in her loving embrace, birth after birth after birth. Samsara chakra. This loving embrace of your mother, this is called loving embrace, when she encircles you with her arms and kisses you. That is also synonymous with the samsara chakra. Embrace means circle. Circle means chakra. Chakra means samsara chakra. Samsara chakra means janma mritu jaravyadhi. So if you stay in the embrace of your mother, it means you stay in the embrace of birth, death, old age, and disease. So obstacles will come. So don't sit down and cry. But get going. Get tough. When the going gets tough, the tough get going. So we have to work very hard sometimes. But these are stimuli for further advancement. Although there may be many obstacles on the path of the sincere devotee who is preaching the glories of the Lord, such obstacles increase the determination of the devotee. We should become more determined when we meet obstacles. For example, you go out preaching. I mean preaching. I don't mean just showing something, you know, hotel guide. You know, we have 100 hotels. Please become a member and join our hotel club. I don't mean that. But when you actually go out and preach and try to convert someone from materialistic thinking to spiritual thinking, convert one who's against Krishna to become favorable to Krishna. That's preaching. Because people are, like one time a devotee said, Prabhupada, no one wants to hear our preaching. And Prabhupada said, of course, that's what preaching means. Nobody invited me to America. No one wrote me a letter. Dear Swamiji, the people of America are ready for you to come. We're waiting for you with the red carpet. Please come. We're all waiting for you to preach Krishna consciousness. And the signature of 200 million people. Invitation card. Nobody invited him. Nobody wanted Krishna consciousness. Nobody wants Krishna consciousness. People want Maya. That's why they're in Delhi. Helly, smelly Delhi. Because they want Maya. So you come and say, please take Krishna. Get out, Maharaj. Here's 100 rupees. Get out. Take your 100 rupees. Get out. I don't want Krishna. But our duty is to give them Krishna and redirect their interests from Maya to Krishna. Turn them around. Turn their heads around. And point them towards Krishna. So, when we go preaching sometimes, people will present some questions to us and obstacles and oppositions, and they will defeat us or bewilder us. And we come back and then we meet with our Guru Maharaj or some senior devotees and say, well, you know, this person I was preaching and he asked this question, how come Bhima just stood there and allowed Draupadi to get this robe? If he's so powerful and so dharmic, why didn't Yudhisthira do anything when Draupadi was getting this robe? And I didn't know what to say. So then he meets with a guru and the guru explains. So he got defeated. He was defeated in that battle, that preaching battle, but that increased his determination to get the answer. To get the answer. So he gets the answer, he studies the books, he gets the answers, and then the next time he goes out preaching, he's ready. Someone asks that question, he can answer it. So this is, we may meet obstacles, but obstacles, when we meet obstacles or difficulties or problems in Krishna consciousness, they should increase our determination to surrender and to advance. That's what's being told here. Jiva Goswami explains, the continuous obstacles placed on the path of a devotee by the demigods form a kind of a ladder or a stairway by which the devotee steadily progresses back to the kingdom of God. There's a verse in Bhagavatam, 10th canto, where it says, O Madhava, O Supreme Personality of Godhead, O Lord of the Goddess of Fortune, if devotees completely in love with you sometimes fall from the path of devotion, they do not fall like non-devotees, for you still protect them. Thus they fearlessly traverse the heads of their opponents and continue to progress in devotional service. Jiva Goswami gave a very nice analogy we just heard. He says that one by one by one by one, the demigods will give obstacles. They will give difficulties, problems, maya, illusions, distractions, and all kinds of problems the demigods will give you. But Jiva Goswami says, each of those obstacles, each of those problems becomes like a stepping stone. They say, they have a phrase in the West, they say, failure becomes the step, what is it? Stepping stone to success or something. They say failure becomes a stepping stone to, you fail, but that becomes a stepping stone to success. In other words, you're crossing a small river, and there's water there, but you don't want to get wet, so you put stones in the river. You step on one stone, and another stone, and you cross over without getting wet. It's called stepping stone. So when you fail, that failure becomes a stepping stone to attain success. Now, Jiva Goswami says all these obstacles are like the steps of a ladder. The demigods are actually giving us a ladder. A ladder means something you climb up to go to the roof. You want to go to the roof, you go up the ladder. Right? I don't know what you call in Hindi, but ladder, you climb up. So all these obstacles, one by one by one, we traverse these obstacles by surrendering to Krishna, and we go higher and higher and higher up the ladder, which means we move closer and closer to Krishna. So actually the demigods are our friends. Because friend means one who reminds you of Krishna, one who pushes you towards Krishna, one who helps you remember Krishna and surrender to Krishna. That is a friend. So in one sense, although the demigods are opposing us and coming as enemies and giving difficulties and obstacles, actually they're our greatest friends because they're pushing us to Krishna. The question is that we hear sometimes we can't surrender to Krishna because our heart is full of lust, and then we hear we can't surrender to Krishna because our heart is full of doubts. So there, how do we correlate these two statements, or how do we relate or connect these two statements? So these two statements are that, like two sides of the coin. Because doubts means you're not sure whether serving Krishna's senses, you're not sure whether serving Krishna's senses is really the best proposal. I can serve Krishna a little bit, but I want to serve my senses also, and serve my sense gratification also. So that means that we have doubts about the idea that I should serve 100% serve Krishna, Rishikesh, and everything will be okay. No, we think, well, if I do that, maybe I'll lose something. Maybe I'll lose. So the lust is also, you know, that's first, that conception is there where we have doubts about serving Krishna. So because we have doubts, then that lust, which is always there, we come back on that lust and we express that lust by enjoying our senses. So lust is also a cause why we're not surrendering. That's one cause because of Prarabdha. But lust makes us doubtful. Because of lust we can't surrender, and because of doubts we can't surrender. We have lust in our heart. Lust means I'm the enjoyer, and I want to enjoy. Now you're trying to convince me that Krishna is the enjoyer. Bhoktaram yagatapasam sarva loka maheshram. You're trying to say in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is saying Bhoktaram yagatapasam, that Krishna, I am the enjoyer, Krishna says. Chapter 5, verse 29, Bhagavad Gita. So you're trying to convince me of that, but I have doubts. I have doubts. Krishna is the enjoyer, but I am the enjoyer too. So I have doubts about that. And because lust is there, so I'm going to, I am doubtful about that. And now because I'm doubtful, I'll express my lust to enjoy, and I'll enjoy my senses. And I won't surrender to Krishna. So they work, they go together. They're inseparable. Because when you're fully convinced about Krishna consciousness, and all the doubts are removed, then when you see these, because you may have conviction in the intelligence, you attain Krishna conscious philosophy and conviction. By studying philosophy, by studying Bhagavad Gita, as I mentioned, like Arjuna heard these verses, especially these four verses in 10th chapter, and he became convinced and became free from all his doubts. Now, we may become convinced and free from all our doubts, but there's still Prarabdha karma within us. We still have Prarabdha karma. We still have so many lusty desires, greedy desires. But if we're convinced about Krishna consciousness, and we're convinced that Krishna is the enjoyer, then when that lust rises within us and tries to make us not surrender to the idea that Krishna is the enjoyer, because we're so convinced, we'll conquer that lust with our conviction. Say, no, that I don't want to surrender to that lusty desire. And then, so the main pivot point to attaining, to surrendering is becoming free from doubts. Because when you're free from doubts, then the other causes of non-surrendering, lust and greed and envy, can be conquered by that conviction that Krishna is the enjoyer, Krishna is the controller, Krishna is the proprietor. But they go together. They're both working to cause us not to surrender. All of our anarthas are working to cause us not to surrender. Anarthas create doubts. And doubts create the inability to surrender. Couldn't hear everything he said. I think I got most of it. He said that in the fifth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, it explains that the devatas are aware that their money is running out. So if you have $100 and you spend a dollar a day, on your 99th day, after 99 days, you'll be holding $1. And you'll be thinking, oh, I only have $1. I better do something quick to get more money, or else when I spend this, I'm flat. The demigods have punya. Punya is like money. And they're living on their punya, shubha karma. They're living off that shubha karma and living so much enjoyment and fantastic lifespan and good health and so much heavenly pleasure. But it's going down, 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 down. They're spending it. They're spending all their credits. And when it's finished, they have to die. And they have to leave that planet. And they have to go down to another Avruya Krichena Param 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 Patantiyado Nadrita Yushmar Angriya. They have to come down. Nadrita. They have to come down to a lower planet. So they know that. Some know that. Some are so intoxicated they don't even know what's going on. But many of the more pious ones that are more, because there's all different levels, just like on this earth planet, not everyone's on the same level of piety. No way. So on Swargaloka, not everyone is on the same level of piety. Some people on Swargaloka are chanting Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Some. Most people on Swargaloka are getting drunk. I mean, they're totally intoxicated. Men and women just singing, dancing, swimming naked in the lakes, just having a good time. But not everyone. So that pious section, that more spiritual inclined section, they have this awareness, it's all going to end. It's all coming to a finish. It will all stop very soon. That section is praying. The other ones are partying. The other ones are just partying day and night. But some are praying. That's discussed in 5th Canto of Bhagavatam. They are praying, oh my Lord, soon my piety will finish. My punya will run out. And soon I must leave this place of heavenly enjoyment. And I must go to earth planet. Because this is the karmasthan. This is the karmasthan, the midway house. This is the midway restaurant. Halfway between Agra and Delhi. The midway. This is the midway. There are 7 planetary systems below. Patala, Rasatala, Talatala, Alatala. And there are 7 planetary systems above. Janalok, Maharlok, etc. There's 7 above. Tapalok, Maharlok, Janalok, Satyalok, Ramalok. There's 7 above, 7 below. This is the midway. So the midway, this is the karmasthan, where karma is, good karma is produced, bad karma is produced, and from here you go up, or from here you go down. So they come back to the earth planet. So they're praying, oh my Lord, I have to leave heaven, I have to leave Swarga, and I have to go to the earth planet. Please, let me take birth in the family of devotees, so I can take up the Nivrti Marg. I've had enough of Pravrti Marg. I had enough of the path of sense gratification. It ends in a dead end. It's a dead end. It ends in defeat. I learned something up here. I want to take birth in the family of devotees. So Prabhupada, he puts that in. He said, yes. He takes that shlokas from Bhagavatam. He says, yes, the demigods are waiting in line to take birth in ISKCON. And literally, the verse says they're praying to take birth in the family of Vaishnavas. Maybe in South India, maybe North, and Vaishnavas. So ISKCON is also Vaishnavas. It's not that they're all praying to take birth in ISKCON, maybe. So now, whether your question is whether or not they know that they're going to run into some opposition, or whether they know that their fellow demigods are going to give them a hard time, maybe that's why the demigods give the devotees a hard time. Because we were also up there in heaven one time, and we came down here, and now we're devotees. And hey, you guys, you're trying to get out, huh? All right, I'll fix you. You were up here with us before. Now you're down on the earth planet being a devotee. Okay, I'll give you a hard time. You know, you're trying to get out. They're envious. I don't know what your question was, but they know it's difficult on the earth planet. Because this is a place of karma and avidya. I mean, karma and avidya, ignorance. There's so much ignorance and hard work here. They know what they're doing. There's Kula Dharma and Samajika Dharma and Patni Dharma and so many dharmas. And Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Sarva Dharman Prittajya, Paritajya, all these dharmas must be abandoned, ultimately. We have family responsibilities, but in human life, when you say, I have a family, there are millions of families in all different species of life. There are bird families, cat families, dog families, fish families, flea families, cockroach families, so many families are there. Now the difference between your family and a family of dogs is one thing, is that you as a human being are meant to surrender your life to God and inculcate in your dependents. In your dependents means your children, inculcate in them moral values, religious values, consciousness and awareness of God. And that makes your family different from the family of the animals. If you're simply maintaining your family, clothing your children, educating your children, protecting your children, feeding your children, giving medicine to your children, that is the same as the animal family. The difference between your family and the duty that you have, the duty that you have that's different from a dog mother or a cat mother or a bird mother, you're also a mother. So there's also a mother dog and a mother bird and a mother flea and a mother cockroach. But the difference is that you are meant to learn about God and teach your babies and teach your children about God. Because no other mother in no other species of life can attain God consciousness. Human life is for God consciousness. Whether you're single or married or student or retired or old or whatever, we must become God conscious and we must give God conscious to our dependents. You are a teacher. It says in 5th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, one has no right. You have no right to be a mother. You have no right to be a father. You have no right to be a teacher. You have no right to be a guru unless you have this quality. You have the ability, if you have the ability to liberate your dependents from samsara chakra, from birth and death, if you have that ability and have that understanding, then you have the requisite or qualification to be a mother, a father, a teacher, and a guru. If not, you have no right to be a teacher. You have no right to be a mother, and you have no right to be a father. So the primary duty of a person in authority is to give God consciousness to his subordinates. So you're a person, you're the authority over your children. And then the king is supposed to be Devarishi or Devarshi. He's supposed to be, or a Maharishi. He's supposed to be a king and a rishi. The king has the authority over all the praja. He controls all the animals in his kingdom and all the people, all the praja. He's the king. So his duty is to lead the citizens towards God. Muktipat, the path of liberation. That is his responsibility. And he just simply increases trade, increases international trade, increases the value of the rupee, increases... That is maya. That is simply keeping people bound in birth and death. The duty of the king is to give God to the people. That's why it's called Naradeva. The king is called Naradeva. He is a deva amongst the Nara. He is a godly person amongst the people. He's a representative of God if he leads the people to God and teaches God consciousness. So modern day, the modern governments are they're non-sectarian. They don't want any sects. No sects, no religion, no. It's just government. Just government. What's that called? Secular state. You do your thing and everybody do their religion at home, inside your house, but not in the government. We want nothing to do with religion. And consequently, all the countries in the world are full of dacoitry and gundism and all kinds of abominable sinful activities. Even the government promotes sinful activities. The government opens abortion clinics. The government puts tax on booze. The government, all sinful activities the government is perpetuating and supporting and encouraging. They're encouraging people to drink whiskey. Why? Because they get taxation, 80% tax on a bottle of whiskey. So they encourage people, drink whiskey. And they encourage people, smoke cigarettes because they get taxed. And they encourage people, oh, have illicit sex, go to our abortion clinic. Okay, so the government encourages people all over the world to engage in the most abominable type of sin so that people stay forever bound in ignorance and forever bound in birth and death. Just the opposite of what a king is supposed to do. A king is supposed to teach people pure life, sattvic life, dharmic life, religious life, liberation, satisfaction, freedom, security, peacefulness. And there's none of those things in the world. No one is peaceful. No one is secure. Everyone's full of anxiety and alienation and disturbance and insecurity and fear. In America and India, all the big countries, it's a cheating process. So when it comes down to your question, you're one little mother in one little apartment with a couple of children and a husband. So your duty is, the obvious duty, any mother of any species of animals will give food and clothing and protection. That doesn't mean you're something special. your speciality as a human being, as you give your children God consciousness. And there's so many comic books that have all the Mahabharata comic books. And you know, India is the ideal place to inject God consciousness in children, because they have hundreds of movies and all kinds of holy places and temples to visit and holy places to go and all these comic books, you know, Mahabharata comic books that are quite good philosophically, even Amrit Chitra Kala or something. I don't know, some kind of, yeah, you know, there's some one comic book they make that is quite good. Philosophically, it's not bad. So you can read these with your children, then when they get older, you can read Bhagavatam with them. And we have so many books in Hindi and English. You read with them, you have Thakur in your home, and they show. Children learn by association. Children are like clay. You get modeling clay, you go like this, you make a rabbit. Go like this, you make a bird. Go like this, you make a model car. However you shape it and mold it, that's how the clay becomes. So your children are just like clay. If you're a demon, your children will become a demon. If you're an asura. So if they see, oh, my mother's bowing down, she's ringing a bell, she's offering incense to Thakurji, her face is so full of devotion, she has so much love for her deities, this will impress them. It goes deep into their heart. Devotion is the most penetrating quality in this world. There's nothing more powerful in this world than love and beauty. Love and beauty are the most powerful material qualities and forces, love and beauty. But when you take this and you have spiritual beauty and spiritual love, they're millions of times more powerful than material love and material beauty. So when you're expressing bhakti, that is spiritual love of the Atma towards the Paramatma, of the Atma towards Bhagavan, of the soul towards God. And that is attractive because Krishna is attractive and bhakti is his aspect. He is the Shaktiman and bhakti is his Shakti. Radharani is Bhakti Devi. Her expansion, Bhakti Devi, is a direct expansion of Srimati Radharani. So when you are trying to express bhakti to God, it will attract your children. They'll because they watch you. Children watch. You don't have to teach them all the time. Now I'm doing arti. Now I'm making an offering. You bring your 3-year-old kid or your 1-year-old kid, you sit them down. Boom. And you do your puja. You do your puja, and you do your bathe your Thakur, and you dress him, and you offer him boga, and you sing, and you do your bhajan, and your kid will just watch. And then when he gets old enough to speak, he'll say, "What are you doing? What is this? Why, what, why? As soon as he starts speaking, he says, "Why and what?" And then you tell him. That's how children learn cooking. You bring the daughter in the kitchen when she's 2 years old and say, "Watch." Mommy's going, "Whoop, whoop, whoop." And the kid's just watching you make chapati. And all of a sudden, you say, "You want to try?" And the kid goes like that and makes this thing that looks like the country of India or something. Her first chapati looks like India. Very nationalistic child. She rolls out her first chapati, looks just like India. Okay, she's getting there. He said, no, you have to turn like this and there. So they learn so much by seeing. So you become a devotee. You give your heart to God. And automatically, you'll do the right. That's the right thing. So they learn by seeing, they learn by hearing, they learn by experience.